Chapter 24. Cannon fodder from the colonies. An enormous flood of humanity, equal in numbers to the French and British armies of 1914, 2,300,000 men in the month of October 1914, was about to pour out onto all the battlefields of the Allies, from Africa, from Asia, and from Oceania. The gleam of their countenances, yellow, copper, black, would be reflected on all the seas of the world. Not even included in these droves were the considerable armies raised in Canada, in Australia, in South Africa, etc., often with the descendants of conquered French, Irish forced laborers, and dispossessed Boers. The Boers, descendants of Dutchmen and French Huguenots, comprised half of South Africa's population. Canada's people included several million descendants of old French settlers. Australia had been built with the blood and sweat of Irish people forcibly brought by the British. They may have been European but had nothing to do with continental quarrels and the political machinations of the very British who had oppressed them. What New Zealander, indeed, could have said in July 1914 whether Sarajevo was a Balkan first name or a brand of Russian caviar? And Mulhouse? And Strasbourg? What Boer from Pretoria, what Australian Irishman could have explained why those towns should be German rather than French or French rather than German? Sending them to die by the tens of thousands in the stinking mud of Artois was already morally indefensible. But what of the Senegalese? Or the blacks turned grey with cold in the chalky trenches of Champagne, and the Malagasies transported like livestock by sea for a month or longer in order to be cast, stupefied, into the barbed wire entanglements of the Chemin des Dames, what about them? What could they understand of the war? What could a German possibly mean to them? And in what way was he different from a Frenchman? Why was he ordered to kill the one rather than the other? And above all, why must he be killed for them? How many of them died? 100,000? 200,000? Who bothered to count? To put those 850,000 luckless wretches through 4 years of carnage was an abominable genocide, all the more odious in that the ones who recruited all this colored cannon fodder pretended to be their defenders. In the recruitment of coloreds, the British establishment had beaten all known records, siphoning off more than 1 million Hindus towards their battlefields, or, more precisely, towards the satisfaction of their interests. Exactly 1,100,000. Destitute men recruited in their arid land with tremendous doses of crude and varied propaganda. Men who wouldn't kill a skinny cow, nor even a fly, were blindly going out to get themselves killed by the hundreds of thousands. Anywhere there was a penny belonging to His Majesty, or a barrel of British oil, or a leak in the maritime monopoly imposed on the world by London, these poor devils in their knee breeches, speaking 800 different languages and marching behind a British swagger stick, would he use ruthlessly. The Hindus, thrown in great numbers onto unknown battlefields, and the coloured subjects of the French colonies, had rapidly been followed by other masses of humanity. Non-combatant workers were brought to the factories of France and the United Kingdom to turn out millions of artillery shells, which the Western Allies scattered over their battlefronts in a rain of death. These workers had been rounded up in the colonies. For example, the future Ho Chi Minh was brought in from Tonkin. A great many others had been recruited in China, for example, the future Chou En-lai. In all, 3 million non-Europeans, for whom the quarrels of Europe were as indecipherable as Sanskrit to an Andalusian vine grower, were brought to swell the ranks of Europe's armies and workers. Senegal, Madagascar, Tonkin, India, and China had not been sufficient for Europe's needs. As early as 1915 it had been necessary to bring the Arabs as well into the ranks of the British. The Muslims had then been promised the reward of the Crescent, that is, a great independent Arab kingdom from the Red Sea to the Persian Gulf, if they joined up with the Allies, and especially with the British troops. The Arabs could be either very dangerous or eminently useful. Turkey, on the side of the Germans since 1914, was the keystone of Islam. The Caliph of Istanbul was its spiritual leader. The Turkish Empire stretched from Thrace and the Bosphorus to the approaches of Egypt. Tens of millions of Arabs were united with Constantinople in the same active and passionate faith. Even beyond the Near East, the spiritual influence of Turkey extended to the most distant colonies of the British Empire, especially to the Indies, where there were more than 100 million devout Muslims. If the British diplomacy proved to be clumsy, the rulers of the empire could anticipate dangerous agitation, insurrections, and revolts fomented in the very heart of their empire. An Islamic holy war would do them more harm than 100,000 German combatants on the Western Front. To gain an alliance with those hundreds of millions of Muslims, 250 million then, 800 million today, and most especially with those who lived in the bosom of the Turkish Empire, was therefore of the utmost military and economic interest to the British. The extraction of petroleum, the blood of the modern world, was undergoing an ever greater development in those countries, where it constituted a sort of private preserve of British interests. As early as 1915, some particularly clear-headed British agents attempted to bring off an agreement with the Arabs. The Arab chiefs who exercised politico-religious power in the torrid lands of Arabia, Syria, and Mesopotamia were nomads first and foremost, without much political importance. They prayed to Mecca and traveled from oasis to oasis on their camels. They lived frugally, eating in those days less caviar and pâté de foie gras than dates. In 1915 they were poor and doubtless happier in their deserts than they would subsequently be in their caramel-colored palaces in Monte Carlo, Geneva, California, and Marbella, or in their gold-plated Mercedes at $2 million apiece. The game of tempting those hardy warriors who lived only for their faith was made easier by the fact that the British had a man on the scene throughout the war, a clever political representative, T. E. Lawrence, who was discreet, realistic, and possessed imagination. He was like a skinny Churchill without the cigar and the cognac. He had been a pupil in France of the Jesuits, the best teachers in the world. Dry as a camel's tail, Lawrence had lived for years among the tribes of the Near East, worming his way into the hearts of the Bedouins, sharing their lives, their dates, their tents, and even homosexual relations with some of them. To hear him tell it and to see him dig up piles of stones, he was an archaeologist. In reality, he was a British spy. He had learned all the Arab dialects and lived as frugally as a camel driver. He would become the great man of Anglo-Arab fraternization. He probably believed in that in all honesty, because in his own way he was a paladin. He would later renounce all honors and official duties when he saw that Britain had hoodwinked his protégés. Returning to England in disgust, he would die there in a highly suspicious motorcycle accident. In 1916 the plan was definite: Lawrence was going to tip Turkish Arabia into the British camp. Throughout 1915 there had been great danger. The only possibility that presented itself to the British at that time was the Arab region of Hejaz, bordering the Red Sea, an area that was infertile and sparsely populated. Its coast was inhospitable, dominated by the winds of the desert and the burning sun. But in the matter of religion, it was of decisive importance. Its capital was Mecca, the millennial town of the Prophet, the religious center of the Muslims. The second town of Hejaz, almost equally famous, was Medina. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims came to Mecca each year. It offered an exceptional opportunity for a propaganda coup. The emir who ruled the Bedouins of Hejaz, if he took a stand against Constantinople, would be able to transform the conditions of the Anglo-Turkish conflict completely. He was named Hussein. He wasn't very rich, and a few felicitous subsidies facilitated the initial British contacts. The money wasn't everything, however. The Arabs were by nature quick to take offense; independence was their life. They had always lived free in their deserts, cleaving to the sand and the wind. They had once possessed one of the greatest empires in the world, from the Ganges to Narbonne. Cordova had sheltered one of their most marvelous mosques, Sicily, their most elegant court. The memory of that great past hovered in the mind of every Arab like the perfume of a secret and everlasting vine of jasmine. The colonial office did its best to court the Emir Hussein. On June 15, the British promised him in writing the reconstitution of a great unified Arab state as soon as the Turks had been vanquished with the collaboration of the Muslims. At the time, the British were generous in fixing the boundaries of the future state. It was no small country, from Mecca to Damascus, from the Red Sea to the Persian Gulf. Under those conditions, the military alliance was worth a try. Sir Henry McMahon, British High Commissioner of the Indies, and Amir Hussein established the nature of that great Arab kingdom in an exchange of 10 letters. From November 4, 1916 on, Hussein would be considered king of the new Free Arabia. The British pledge was categorical, though secret, as was everything the British government signed. It was almost too beautiful. The Adriatic had already been promised to the Italians by the Treaty of London, which was also secret, whereas in fact that territory had been considered a fief of the Serbo-Russians since the beginning of the war. With an equally imperturbable commercial sense, the British had offered Macedonia to the Bulgarians in 1915, whereas by verbal commitment it belonged to their Serbian ally. In the same fashion, the territories granted and guaranteed to the Arabs in 1916 would be granted and guaranteed by these same Britishers in part to the French and in part to the Italians. Even the Jews would be guaranteed part of the spoils, Palestine, which had already been allotted to the Russians. Moreover, these generous distributors, with the same jealous secrecy, and behind the backs of the Arabs, who were theoretically satisfied, had allocated to themselves the most savory morsels of this same Near East, notably those where petroleum flowed even more bountifully than the milk and honey of the Bible. A sextuple distribution. Each one was carried out on the quiet, with the Greeks ignorant of what had been promised the Italians unaware of what had been awarded to the Russians, nor did the Russians know what had been assigned to the French, nor the Arabs what had been promised to the Jews. The British had concluded each agreement without the knowledge of any of the other confederates. That made 7 separate competitors and beneficiaries who would collapse screaming when they discovered at the Versailles table in 1919 that there were no less than 7 dinner guests invited to eat the same dish at the same time. Moreover, the British establishment had no sooner promised Hussein, the newly minted monarch, sovereignty over an Arab kingdom 3 million square kilometers in area, 6 times the size of France, then on March 9, 1916 they personally secured magnificent possessions for themselves in the same territories. The signatories of that pact, once again a secret one, were the Frenchman, Georges Picot, and the Briton, Sir Mark Sykes, whence the name of the Sykes-Picot Treaty. The British, then, magnanimously allotted themselves the petroleum of the Tigris and Euphrates area. The French were awarded the administration of the coasts of Lebanon and a preponderant influence in Syria, so preponderant that it would be established on the day of reckoning in 1919 with cannon fire. Those agreements annihilated the commitment solemnly accorded to Hussein of a great Arab kingdom, which was thereby deprived of its most important territories. The British would end up by bringing an unexpected wolf into the secret sheepfold, the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which the Allies judged indispensable if they wished to obtain the support of Jewish finance and the Jewish press in the United States and force Woodrow Wilson's hand. It would grant the Zionists a homeland at the expense of the Arabs and assure to each Jewish immigrant a keg of powder that would work wonders at the proper time. This triple play of the Foreign Office, wrote the Belgian historian Delaunay, the starting point of the contradictions in British policy in the Levant, was to be fraught with consequences. It would be half a century before the Arabs would succeed more or less in unraveling this sextuple web of closely woven threads in which the British, between 1915 and 1918, had imprisoned them from head to foot. Despite the fact that the Arabs made up more than 90% of the population of Palestine in 1918, they would never succeed in throwing off the Israeli web woven by Balfour. For the moment, and that was all that interested the British in 1916, the entire Arab world, mounted on their swift camels, brandishing daggers and knives, hurled themselves on the Turks, with Lawrence, who had become the intimate friend of the son of King Hussein, the Emir Faisal, at their side. The latter was a splendid prince, as impressive as a prophet when he appeared, wrapped in his white jalaba and armed with his dagger set with diamonds. He and Lawrence attracted new allies. They didn't lack for pounds sterling, British banknotes, for Muslim lives. Thanks to those funds, they acquired confederates, stirred up the tribes, and assembled that desert army that British diplomacy alone would never have succeeded in raising. In addition to cunning and courage, they had physical stamina. Those warriors, though eating little, they were always combat ready, tireless, indefatigable. The Arab people, now often painted as ludicrous revelers, were then noble, loyal, trusting, and hospitable. The United Kingdom used them much and misused them even more. Without them, how far would the British imperialists have gotten in their riding breeches? In the end, poor Faisal would lose out, and would even be driven from Mecca by his Saudi rival, Ibn Saud, another magnificent warrior. But British gold, as it had done in Europe for centuries, paid all rivals indiscriminately in order to get them to kill each other advantageously. Europe was dying due to British duplicity, and Arabia was on the point of dying, too. In the fight against the Turks, the Arabs furnished the British with splendid reinforcement troops from 1916 to 1918. When facing the Turks in 1916, the British, just like the French, had seen their big cruisers go to the bottom in the neck of the Sea of Marmora and their soldiers die by the thousands at Gallipoli of misery, cold, and typhus. The route from the Suez Canal to Aleppo was open in 1917 and 1918 only because some tens of thousands of Muslim warriors throughout all of Arabia heroically carried the colors of the hope of the Prophet at the end of their lances. Those colors were not exactly the Union Jack. Nor in the course of those battles did one see shining the six-pointed star that now floats autocratically over Jerusalem. The Allied War of Right, in Arabia, as elsewhere, was the cannon fodder from the colony's omnipotent war of force. The Europeans ruined themselves morally in the eyes of foreign peoples, especially the Muslims, by stooping to these base plots, flinging showers of lying promises everywhere, cynically hoping to obtain fraudulent dividends. Sooner or later Europe would pay for this, and see the mirage of two easy swindles vanish in the burning air of those marvelous countries.